Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we get into today's show, I have some urgent news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $65,000 by that date. The great news is a generous friend of the ministry has offered to match the first $10,000 given to help jumpstart giving towards this goal. But we must fully meet the $10,000 for it to be released. That's why I wanted to take a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, part of Faith Explored here on Premier Christian Radio every Saturday, helping Christians and non-Christians to think through their worldview. And I hope you like what we've got lined up for you today. It's not what I advertised at the end of last week's programme. For that, I apologise if you're tuning in or listening via podcast expecting to hear a discussion between Peter Enns and David Instone Brewer. In fact, we're holding that over till next week. I got my dates confused. So look forward to hearing that at the same time next week. Today, we're talking about Halloween, and I've got some very special guests joining me who I'll introduce in just a moment's time. Don't forget that we always like to read some of your feedback to the show, and we'll be giving out the ways to get in touch a little later on. And I've got a whole bag of correspondence to last week's show on abortion, which was a subject we tackled for a second time last week. But if you're listening later on this afternoon and you want to know what's coming up, well, the profile will be here. Two guests are going to be in studio, Lou Fellingham, author and singer, and pastor and author Carl Martin. So watch out for that between 4 and 5. That will complete the schedule for Faith Explored this Saturday afternoon. If you enjoy Unbelievable specifically and you want to get more shows along this lines, then why not check out the all-new Unbelievable webpage? That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And we have, I think, at last managed to sort out our issues with our slightly dodgy RSS feed on podcast. So if you've been experiencing any issues, you should find those resolved now. Do let me know, of course, if you do have any problem, if you're listening online to the programme and that's the way you receive Unbelievable every week. OK, well, let me tell you what's coming up on today's show.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the show, we're talking to a witch as we talk about Halloween. That's happening next week, and a day that has more association these days with witches, spooks and scary stuff than its Christian origins as the eve of the Festival of All Souls. But today on Unbelievable, as I mentioned, I'm going to be joined by a witch. We're going to be introduced to him in just a moment, and a Christian guest today. Now, the witch in question doesn't have a broom or a pointy hat with him. He is indeed Thomas Campbell, and he's here to tell us about his beliefs and practices as a Wiccan, and about Samhain, I think that's how it's pronounced. We'll get it from Tom in a moment's time. The pagan terminology for Halloween. My other guest today on the programme is Steve Hollinghurst, my Christian guest, and he's a vicar and a freelance researcher, regularly engages with the New Age and pagan community, and is going to be bringing a Christian perspective to our conversation about witches, magic and Halloween today. And I'll give you information on how you can find out more about both of them as the programme progresses. A very warm welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Good morning.
In today's
programme.
Tam, which is the way that I think your name is often pronounced in your native Scotland. Thanks for coming on the programme today. I introduced you as a witch, which is not the way I've ever introduced anyone on this programme before, but that conjures up immediately all kinds of strange images in most people's minds. But what led you towards where you are today in terms of your beliefs as a Wiccan? And is that the same as being a witch, is also my question.
Wiccans are witches. Not all witches are Wiccans.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. There are many people who have many different ways of looking at the gods and looking at their spirituality. It is what the gods write in their hearts that matters, not the labels we give them. I started off at college and met a member of Alexander's group. That got me on the path.
When you say Alexander's group, is this someone who's significant within the world?
Yes, yeah. Many mm-hmm. years ago. Mm. And took me a few years to make my decision because I was involved in Buddhism at the time.
Okay.
And then eventually I decided to look into it, at which point on a local shop there was a little advert. If you're interested in the Wicca, come to a certain pub.
Right.
In Bromley. So I went and I met someone else, but nobody else went away. Next month I went back, still nothing. Month after that, then on the fourth or fifth month, someone came up and asked me, since I'd been there a lot, was I interested in this? That's how I started.
You were quite persistent in that sense.
You have to be. We do not ask people to come. They must come of their own free right. choice. And we're not overly keen on sort of pushing them.
So you're not evangelistic in that sense?
Seriously not. It's a tenet of faith. A person's beliefs and how a person views the Godhead is unique to them.
Mm.
How we view the Godhead is unique to us. We do not tell them that we are better or worse than them. We are just ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I've mentioned no broomstick, no black cat, no pointy hat. What is, for you, the essence of being a Wiccan, a witch within that tradition?
It is a mystery. A mystery religion, echoing the past mystery religions, which is a special relationship to how we see our gods. Our gods being the earth, the sky, the heavens, all things. And we see ourselves as being in close proximity to them. We are the priests and priestesses of the goddess and the god, as we see the Godhead.
In that sense, it's a very much a nature sort of focused religion. Would that be fair to say?
Very much. Our chapel is a forest.
Mm-hmm.
The rafters are the stars. The song of birds are our choir.
Mm-hmm. And in what sense then would you say you believe in divinity or God? Do you see that as very much represented in the natural world, or do you believe in, if you like, a creator of the natural world beyond that?
I believe that the gods as we know them are transcendent. To define them in such terms, whether that be the Christian God or any other God, is to limit it down.
Mm-hmm.
We may do that in order to ourselves conceptualise what we think, mm-hmm. but they are beyond all of these things.
And you're using the plural there, they.
Oh, yes.
So in that sense, I suppose I'm trying to nail down, do you believe in a plurality of individual spirits, gods, in that sense, or is this a terminology that's helpful?
Both. The fact of the matter is that each witch will, or each Wiccan will look at the gods in their own way. But I believe they are beyond both singularity and plurality. That in fact, to do such things in terms of the infinite is of no real value.
Mm.
The infinite is both. So we believe both in one God and in many gods, but they're both the same. In Buddhism, for instance, you have the Tathagatas, Bodhisattva, for instance, who have many arms to represent the many aspects. We are the same.
We'll talk about Halloween, which I think is termed Samhain in your tradition, in a moment's time. But generally, you've told us kind of about the worldview in that sense of perhaps a typical Wiccan. But what does it look like in terms of actual practicality? For a Christian, that would probably involve going to church on Sunday and praying and reading the Bible and that kind of thing. What do you do as a Wiccan that marks out the way that you practice your faith?
Our Bible is the air, the land and the sea. Our church is to go out and watch the glory of nature. Having said that, as a Wiccan, I believe that I have my own special relationship with the gods. We work at all times with reverence to the gods, whether the gods be plural or singular, just as you would in a church.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't go into a church and start sort of singing away in the back. Well, not singly. I wouldn't go into the woods and start acting, chopping down trees and stuff.
Mm.
Basically, I would consider this to be a sacrilege.
And would it involve any kind of rituals on certain days of the year? I know that the cycles of the moon are sometimes important within certain aspects of Wicca and that kind of thing. What might that practically look like in terms of the way you express those beliefs?
Now, one thing you've got to remember about the Wiccan and about paganism in general and witchcraft of all its sorts is that we are a religion of feeling, of direct experience. When we do ritual, we are doing nothing more than enacting and reenacting, if you like, our own expressions of our relationship with the gods. It is the language of magic and worship. The structure and the seed upon which the subconscious can be set to act. It's a psychodrama.
Okay. And would that be involve kind of acting out a kind of some kind of role play or ritual within a sort of, I don't know, a forest setting? This is all just kind of what's in my mind as possibilities here. But what might that, can, you know, could you give us an example of something?
We will often do that. Sometimes it may be a drama. For instance, if you look at the last, the equinox, the autumn equinox, you have the John Barleycorn, which is the drama of the cutting off the sheaves of corn and their conversion into nutriments and particular into ale, where we celebrate and thank the gods for the gift of the life of food, not only for ourselves, but for all mankind, so that all may be happy and full.
And what would that look like? How does that get acted out when you're together?
Well, there's one thing I should say. Witches play or throw a really good party. We work for joy and for laughter, and our rituals often include joy and laughter, usually, in fact, always do. So the ritual that will be done in love, but it will be done as a personal expression of the gods within a structure. That structure can be written down, or it can be rehearsed, or it can be just spontaneous, depends on the particular group of people we're working with, you know, because we work with different people all the time. It is basically a structure which allows us to express ourselves.
I mean, I suppose I'm thinking sort of, you know, in the Christian church, practically across all Christian denominations, the ritual that we share in common is communion. And it's physical elements are wine or some kind of grape juice, bread or a wafer, and everyone partaking of these symbols and elements to remind themselves of Christ's death.
And we have that at the end of the ritual. Mainly at the end of the ritual when we've celebrated all sorts of other things, some of which my oaths tell me I must keep to myself. However, we bless wine, or in my case, mead, because I much prefer it, with the words, "May you never thirst," and we then give that to the next person with a blessing that in their life they will never thirst or be in need. Then we bless cakes, normally oatmeal made in a crescent, some with honey, and we then pass that on with the blessing, "May you never hunger."
Well, we'll get more, because I'm fascinated by the whole area, and it'd be interesting to hear more from you about it in a moment's time. We must introduce Steve, though, as well, on today's guest. Steve, you've been on years ago now to Unbelievable, and I can't believe we haven't had you on for so long. But just give us a quick sketch of your background and how you got involved in particularly this kind of dialogue with pagan culture.
I mean, there's two things going on here. Partly it's my own spiritual journey. So when I became spiritually aware, if that's the right kind of terminology, which was in my teenage years. I did an enormous amount of exploring. I think it would probably be right to say I was a practicing occultist of some kind for a number of years in my teens before settling on Christianity as
what
own
did
path.
That involve Ouija yeah. boards, that kind of thing?
No, ironically, as a practicing cultist, that's probably the last thing you do, because it seems fairly stupid from that perspective, actually. But I did do sort of rituals in which I believed I was involved in summoning spiritual beings. Various meditation practices, mm-hmm. Reading stuff, tarot, astrology, I dabbled in an enormous
right.
amount of things.
Okay.
And that was part of my spiritual journey. Now, we then move on a number of years. I ended up doing a youth outreach evangelism job in an area of Nottingham, and suddenly realised I was totally out of my depth and didn't know what I was doing. But that got me very interested in examining what was going on in culture, because I realised that my church background was simply not connecting with people at all. And as I started researching what was happening in culture, one of the things I became incredibly aware of was an enormous rise in spirituality, if that's the right phrase, outside of the conventional religions, sure. part of which was a rise in paganism or things coming from the New Age. And I became very interested in that as part of my research. And I've maintained that interest over a number of years now.
As it were, when you became a Christian, did you sort of see all the stuff you dabbled in as kind of behind you, or did you see them as still having some kind of relevance to your ongoing
journey? I think that's my view of that has changed over my life. So I did the classic thing I actually burnt a whole load of material at that point in time, much of which I now regret. I will be straight with you. You often overswing in some of these things. And whilst there are some parts of what I did that I would now say are not appropriate for me, as I think, as a Christian, there are other parts that I've actually returned to and reincorporated. I think a number of the meditation practices, for instance, I found incredibly useful. And you find things like that actually run across many faith traditions. And
but,
of course, there's
but
a whole Christian tradition of that.
Directed in a more Christological kind of focus?
Yes, I think so. I mean, though the nature thing's very interesting, you see. As Tam's talking earlier, one of the things I'm involved in is a thing called Forest Church, which is about Christians re-engaging with nature, which I think at the roots are an enormous part, actually, of what formed particularly Northern European Christianity. But something I think we kind of lost in our modern age. Mm. And one of the things I've found from engaging with pagans of various things is they kind of promote, you know, that idea comes up and you go, well, that's really interesting. Where's that in our tradition? Mm. And an awareness that it's there, but buried. So that's a conscious attempt to, you know, so many of the festivals of the Christian year are based on natural seasons. Mm. And there's a reason for that. I think it's to do with how Christianity engaged in the very early years with the faiths and peoples it found around it as it spread across the then Roman Empire. And much of the connecting points were to do with the understanding of of what's going on in the seasons of the year. So we're trying to re-engage with that. So, you know, when Tam talks about being out in the woods or with the birds, I'm going, yeah, I like doing that too.
Interesting stuff. Thank you very much for joining the programme today, Steve. And we're going to be talking as well on today's show about Halloween with my guest, as we've heard already, Thomas Campbell, Tam, as he's going by on today's programme, is a Wiccan, and he's here to tell us about his beliefs and practices and also about what happens at Halloween. Steve Hollinghurst, our Christian guest, who regularly engages with the New Age and pagan community, bringing a Christian perspective to our conversation. And if you'd like to get in touch yourself, you can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget you can leave comments with today's programme as well at the website, where you can listen back to today's show. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We're available on Twitter and Facebook and all the rest too. All the links available though from that web page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So let's continue this chat about Halloween. And What for you is Halloween, Tam? Because I think for many people, they see the bright orange and black outfits in Tesco's. It's about the trick-or-treating, the little pointy forks and devil costumes and all the rest of it. Now, I know many Christians who give it a very wide berth because they feel that it does have all these associations with things that they believe are occult or spiritual practices that they're keen not to have their children or themselves involved in at some level. But that may be a million miles from what you think of as Halloween, of course. So I'd be interested to know what your take on it is.
First of all, the actual Americanization of Halloween or Samhain is, to me, an appalling thing. You're right. If I would not be happy with children running around as little devils or zombies or, you know, ghosts, because I feel that is not really what the thing's about. Halloween is a time when we remember those who have gone before, when we feast with them, and we feast with them in terms of symbolism, of course. We often call it the Feast of the Dead. It is also our New Year, because this time of Samhain was the beginning of the Celtic New Year, when they remembered and looked back at those who had gone before them and whom they loved in the last year. And they would light fires to guide the souls to the other world. So with us, we will light candles and we will ask that the blessings of the gods and the protection of the gods be upon the souls of those we have loved, that they may return and love us once more in another life. That's the exact, if you like, complete Halloween Samhain in a nutshell.
I mean, in that sense, is that where the association with ghouls and ghosts and so on has come from? Because it's associated with this idea of people passing on, as it were.
Well, that's a cultural thing for both the Scots and the Irish. When I was a child, we celebrated what you would call Halloween in the way that was celebrated for millennia, which is a time when the world of phantom and the world of material are closest. Any time it's a time of change. And that way we would think that the fairies would come and they could steal children.
Right.
We would then dress the children up in their dad's old shirts, in shoes that were too big for them, put soot on their face and carve a turnip lantern to scare the she away. This is the thing that I think developed into the idea of ghosts and goblins.
Right, sure.
But originally it was to avoid ghosts and goblins.
Right. Okay, that's an interesting perspective on it. So what are you going to be doing yourself on the 31st of October, Tam?
We will be basically remembering those who have gone before, those of our loved ones, and all who have gone before, and thinking about them, giving them our love and our blessings to move on, and celebrating their lives and their future.
And if I might pray again, I'm always interested in practical details, but again, is this going to be in a sort of a forest setting? Are you going to be doing this at night? Is it a sort of something that takes place, you know, with any particular ritual aspect to it?
Well, basically, if it's warm enough. However, most Halloweens, especially the further north you get, and if you think I'm running around in the snow, you're far mistaken. I will do that if it's a warm night. We sometimes like to go out, normally with a good fire to guide the souls of those who have gone before. Because, like the Scots and the Irish, we believe that the time, the barrier between this world and the next is closest and thinnest at this time of year.
Okay, so there is a special sort of significance to that day and doing it on that day. Do you believe you in any way contact or commune with those spirits as they're making that transition?
In my faith and love for them. However, we do not go around calling up the dead or anything like that, because that is... we consider such things to be a bit arrogant. Why should we disturb those who have gone before?
Right. And so any kind of sense of witchcraft that involves summoning dead people or doing those kinds of things. You personally don't actually subscribe to that kind of a...
We will invite the dead to our feast.
Okay.
However, having said that, and witches tend to be sceptics, those who believe in the dead being there will believe so. Those who believe it is a symbol will also believe so.
Yeah. So in a sense, it's not as though everyone gathered will be thinking the same thing is happening in exactly the same way.
They will be seeing their own experience.
Sure. Okay. Does this tally with what your experience of people you've met and the way they view Halloween in the community?
I think the first thing to say is that you know, I think Tam's very eloquently put his position across there, and there are a whole raft of pagan positions, but they would be quite similar. I think that's the first thing to say there. Now, the other thing to say is that actually I think what we've rightly raised is, you know, the supermarket image of Halloween. And the odd thing here is that the pagan community and the Christian community are actually going to find they're quite close on this one.
They both dislike the commercial version.
They both dislike the commercialisation. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. One of the interesting things about, you know, because the name Halloween is, of course, a Christian name, All Hallows Eve.
Yes.
As part of the Christian connection with Northern Europe, a pope in about the 7th century moved All Souls and All Saints from its traditional point at Pentecost, which is where the Eastern Church still celebrated, onto the 1st of November.
Right. And was this because of a pagan sort of thing was already happening there and he thought...
It is likely that that's the case. Now, our problem here is, and this is another problem that the pagan community has, we have very little detail about what actually happened in some of those early festivals. And the irony is almost that Christianity may be one of the ways that's preserved it in moving to that date. But in a sense, what we've done is taken that time of year as Christians to celebrate the saints who have gone before us and our predecessors. So it's the time of year we remember our dead.
If you're in a traditional church, you might sing "For All the Saints Who From Their Labours Rest." Is the festival
you might
of
indeed.
All saints.
And actually, my wife runs a parish church, and on the Sunday they will have a quite conscious service of remembering the dead, and they will invite people who've had funerals, will all get invitations to come, they'll go and light a candle for their dead relative, and things like that. Actually, in the Forest Church community I celebrate, on the Saturday afternoon, we will be outside with a fire, and it's something I've developed that goes with this, but we'll actually... You're looking at how the seasons work. So you've got the falling leaves of the season, and it relates rather to the falling people, if you can see the analogy there. And so what we will do is actually we'll take leaves to remember those who are loved ones, who our predecessors, and we float them across water as a way of thinking about offering those people into God's care.
Yeah.
Which would be my understanding of that.
Well, we're going to continue to pick this up in a moment's time. Listening to a discussion today on Halloween, my two guests are Tam. He's a witch. He's in the Wiccan sort of tradition in that sense, and he's already explained to us a little bit about what that means in terms of beliefs and practice, and we'll be continuing to talk about Halloween with him and Steve Hollinghurst, my Christian guest, who regularly engages with New Age and pagan community and has started to see some of the benefits of actually appreciating some of the advantages, if you like, of connecting with some of the ancient traditions and rituals in that community and bringing it within the Christian community. So I wonder what you think about this. Be interested in your thoughts. I'm sure you don't agree with everything that's being said on the programme, but if you don't, why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Be interested to hear your thoughts about it. And we'll be continuing this discussion in a moment's time.
Premier Christianity, for cutting-edge commentary and encouraging stories.
Tackling the big issues to help you live out your faith.
Read our latest female-focused edition to find out what being a 21st century Christian woman means. Hannah Mudge explains why Christians shouldn't be scared of feminism. Carrie Lloyd shares the struggles of being a single 30-something in a sexualized world. And Heather Tomlinson rediscovers the ancient art of head covering and finds she actually quite enjoyed it. All that, plus news, views and your favourite columnists.
For your free copy of Premier Christianity, visit premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Continuing to talk about Halloween this afternoon, and whether you're listening live this Saturday or as part of our podcast at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, hope you're enjoying the discussion. By the way, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback, of course, later on in the programme to the last few weeks of programming, and be giving you the ways to get in touch again later on as well. Lots more resources, videos, past shows and much more available from the website of today's show. So do go there to find out more about my guests as well. I'll be mentioning where you can find out more about them as well later on. So Halloween is next week. It's a day that often has more association with witches, spooks and scary stuff than its Christian origins, as the eve of the festival of All Hallows. But today on Unbelievable, I'm joined by a Christian guest and a witch. The witch in question, as I said, doesn't have a broom and a pointy hat. He is Thomas Campbell, and he is here to tell us about his beliefs and practices as a Wiccan. Samhain, am I pronouncing this correct? Is that the way you would pronounce...
Think of it like summer's end, summon.
Samhain.
Put a W in. Samhain.
And this is the name given in sort of pagan tradition to this particular time
this
of year, the festival.
This is the name given in the Irish tradition.
Okay.
There are, for instance, in the Tom Bocooley, the book of the War of the Brown of the Bulls, and in a few other things, descriptions of Samhain. Some of them about how they used to have excuses for a big feast, which was a bit... But they also had some other things. For instance, one of the interesting things about the Tawn is talking heads, the old Celtic view that the head could talk and prophesy after it had been removed from the body. There is such a warning that goes on in the old Irish tales. But these are the tales of the past. We live in the modern world, and our view of Samhain is that of seeing in our minds our loved ones once more and saying how much we love them and celebrating their lives.
When it comes to, you've already said you have a very live and let live kind of approach to the way other people approach God and religion. What have you ever dabbled, for want of a better word, with Christianity? Did you sort of ever have a point at which that would have been described as your
I was faith? Brought up a Christian. I was brought up a Catholic, in fact. It's quite funny that I was given an emergency baptism because I was a twin.
Oh, really?
I was then given the last rites and given a second baptism with my sister a few weeks later when I actually found I was recovering.
I see.
That was when I was born. So up until the age of about 22, 23, I was a Christian. And quite a sincere Christian as well. I was involved in quite a lot of Christian organisations, not just Catholic, but many other ones. And had all the usual sort of activities of the worship of God and the reverence of Christ. We don't stop revering people. We may not believe that Christ particularly... Well, it's not fair. Christ is the Son of God, but to us, all are the sons of God and the daughters of God.
But you obviously don't believe in the unique significance that Christians ascribe to Christ as God in flesh, as it were.
To a Christian, this is true. Therefore, there is a truth to it. We respect their belief in that. I do not believe that Christ is totally unique. He was a human being to me. But I also respect that there are those who believe that his divine nature was unique.
I mean, I can imagine, I'm trying to think of some listeners thinking, but hang on. You say it's true for you, but I've got a different view. But then, obviously, both things can't be objectively true, if you like. Either Christ was or was not God in the flesh. So, in a sense, at some level, if I had to push you, Tam, would you say that in the end, obviously, you don't believe that? But you're obviously very happy for someone else to believe that.
Well, this would probably be accurate. I mean, to say I don't believe it is to make it dogmatic, to make it, oh, you shouldn't be doing that. And this is not true.
Right.
It is not up to me to tell somebody else what they should or shouldn't be doing. Your perception of the Godhead is your own. Mine is mine. So your perception is as valid and as likely to be what you think the Godhead is as mine is for me. So I'm trying to hedge this simply because I'm not going to go around giving people the idea that they should not be doing this or this is wrong, because there's no such thing as wrong.
There's no such thing as wrong?
Not in this case. Have you ever heard of the philosopher Berlin? He was, his ethics, the pluralistic ethics, where many things can be seen in our ethics, which on face value may be contradictory, but which in fact are not so much contradictory, they coexist. Take the fact that we can have an absolutist form of ethics. Human life, all life has a right to live. That's absolute. There's no change. On the other hand, you could say, yes, but in Scotland, they have a right to be rained on. That may be relative. Or on the other hand, you may say that a particular culture has a particular thing which is good for them. That's relative. The two can coexist in my head at the same time, right, happily.
So you don't believe in that sense in an objective realm of sort of values or morals, that it depends on time and place and people?
It depends on paradigm, but then if you look at Thomas Kuhn's, for instance, and his ideas on paradigms, a truth is not an objective thing.
I think there's something very important culturally here. That I'm hearing in what Tam's saying and actually in the way you asked the question, Justin. Sometimes when I'm talking to people about this, I have a video clip I play of an interview between a Christian and a New Ager in Glastonbury Abbey. And the Christian says to the New Ager, but surely there are objective external truths. And the other guy basically responds, no, it's all about your own experience. And we're dealing here not only with something here that's about faith paths. Actually, we're dealing, I think, something culturally that I might call about post-modernity as opposed to modernity. So, but as Christians, we've all been raised with a faith that has spent hundreds of years wrestling with modernity. And so we have a tendency to phrase questions as true or not true.
Sure.
And we live in a culture that increasingly thinks that's not a relevant question, and this is one of the things I think going on here, actually.
Where do you stand then in that sense? How do you parse that out, Steve? As someone who calls yourself a Christian but obviously wants to engage with and value the parts of pagan tradition that you see as still having value and so on. And if I were to ask you the same question about, well, at the end of the day, is Christ the Son of God, or has in that sense, at what level would you say, like Tam, all beliefs are equally valid in that sense?
I think firstly there's a number of things going on here. I would say ultimately I think there are truths. The issue is not whether things are or are not true, it's our ability to completely know them that's the issue.
Okay.
So I would say I believe that something completely unique was happening in Christ in the way God became human. Now, I think one of the interesting things about that is that my understanding would be that part of Christ becoming human is to enable the human to discover the image of God within itself. And so I think sometimes we can overplay the distance between God in Christ and the image of God in men and women. I think it's Irenaeus, one of the early theologians, who says that God became man, that man might become God. And he doesn't mean by that we would be equal to the transcendent all out there being, but that the divinity, the good in us, the God image in us is raised up by what Christ does. But I think that's a unique thing. And we may well disagree on that.
Yeah, sure.
I don't think we will. I think that's perfectly agreeable.
Okay.
I have no problem with that. However, Dan the Bard, who's one of our great musicians in Port, that I have the honour to be a friend of his, has a song about a pagan and a Christian priest meeting. And in the song, he says, "I am green and grey, not black and white. Green for love of the earth, grey for acceptance that everybody has both their human faults and their human excellences."
Mm, yeah. I'd be interested to know, in that sense, what did you make of Jesus then, as a Wiccan, Tam? Do you believe he was some kind of a guru, in some sense a Wiccan himself? I don't want to, you know, put words in your mouth, but what was this extraordinary character? Now, obviously, we heard from Steve that he believes he had this unique aspect to who he was. What do you make of him, though?
Well, I make of him as unique as well. Now, to say he a Wiccan, or to make such glib, you know, "Oh, yes, he was a pagan," is not, it's a form of hubris, because he was a Jew of his time, and a practicing Jew, but a person whose concept of the world stepped beyond that. In terms of his life, you see that he has consort with tax collectors, with prostitutes,
publicans and sinners,
in a world where that would be a shocking thing. To have such in that world, you have to be a very brave person. This was a time when, for instance, the Sicarii were going around assassinating people who they didn't actually think believed the same as them. They were a particular sect of assassins. So his whole thing is that of a brave, noble and enlightened person.
I was about to say the very same word and you came up with it, enlightened. I mean, in that sense, many different faith traditions have drawn on Jesus down the years as sort of an ennobling kind of character, whether they be, you know, Buddhist, Eastern traditions and that kind of thing. In that sense, he's shared across, in that sense, many types of faith. But do you accept that obviously your view of him there doesn't necessarily correspond to the way many Christians would agree with a lot of what you said? He was brave, he was enlightened, but that he was the Son of God kind of puts him in a separate category to the rest of what humanity is perceiving.
Well, yes, except that we would say, since everybody is the Son of God, of course he was the Son of God. He was the same as everybody else.
But they don't mean it in that way. They don't mean it. I would call myself a Son of God, in a child of God, let's say, in that way. But I don't. That I'm not thinking of it in quite the same way as we talk of Jesus as co-equal with the Father and the Spirit, as it were.
Yes, I think perhaps I've had these discussions with for instance, Muslims who would say that Christianity is, in fact, a
polytheistic religion.
Polytheistic religion, yeah. Because there are the three aspects of the Godhead, the Trinity. I can only say that, again, I cannot make didactic statements to other people. For me, he was a great and noble man.
Without trying to make you make any didactic statements, Steve, what do you think Jesus would make of the Wiccan approach to spirituality?
I rather suspect, okay, Jesus has a habit of saying to people sometimes, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And he says that as a very positive thing.
Okay.
I suspect if he turned up in many a pagan gathering, that might be what he would say. Where does Jesus? I mean, firstly, I have to be slightly careful because, you know, to what extent can I actually speak for Jesus? I think is a thing here. So I can speak to my understanding of him. Jesus was about life in all its fullness. You know, and that's one of the things. He was about celebration. He was about setting people free so that they could come alive to the image of God within them. I think I would take a phrase from St. Paul, that he was about the conquering of what Paul would call, and all of these words are going to be problematic, but I'm going to use them anyway, sin, death and the devil.
Mm.
They're all problematic words because we load stuff onto
sure.
them. But I think a sense of an imprisonment mm. of who we are and a need to break the power of that within us, which is destructive and mars that image of God within us, so it can come freely mm. to the surface.
Mm.
So for me, those are the essences of what my faith journey is about. But there's an enormous amount here about the celebration of life, the very act of celebration. I've never been to a Wiccan ceremony, and I think there are understandable reasons for that. I have been to a number of Druid ceremonies because they're often open. Mm. And one of the things I note is that they're often a darn sight more fun than many church services. You know, the idea of actually celebrating and of really entering into what is going on in the world around us, I think is very positive. And I think it speaks back to Christians to say, well, okay, how do we do this? How do we engage?
Many Christians will take the approach, Steve, and I'm sure you've come across them, of have nothing to do with it. Mm. Keep it at arm's length. Don't go there, basically. Now, you take a very different approach. You have regularly rock up with friends at a psychic fair or a New Age fair or whatever yeah. it might be, and you'll actually offer, alongside the Reiki healers and the Druids and whoever else is offering their stuff, Christian prayer and meditation yeah. and so on. Now, what is it about that approach that makes you confident to kind of just sit alongside all these different variations of belief and offer your one amongst them all?
Well, I think the first thing to say is we've already talked about how Jesus was out there with the prostitutes, the publicans, the tax. There can be no no-go areas for Christians. If we're followers of Jesus, everywhere is open to us mm-hmm. to go. And so this kind of, oh, keep yourself separate thing, I just don't see how a follower of Christ can take that attitude. Now, I do see that people do. Mm. I think sometimes it's motivated. There's a good part of the motivation. People are wanting to live their lives in a certain way, and they fear what may mm. happen to them. I understand that. I think the fear aspect, though, is deeply unhelpful as well. Why should I, as a Christian, particularly if I really do believe... Mm. That Christ is with me and I am, through that, connected to the God who is over all and fills all, why should I be afraid of being somewhere?
Sure.
I think is the thing. Then I think there's another thing we have to recognise about our contemporary culture and the place of Christianity in it. Christians have been rather used to several centuries of being the only show in town, apart from things going on in the margins mm-hmm. that people often try and pretend aren't happening. We're no longer the only show in town. There is a great spiritual marketplace out there. And we just have to acknowledge we're there in the marketplace. We either decide to withdraw mm-hmm. or we're there.
Okay.
Can I just, for instance, look at the opinion of Christ himself, and we have this opinion. We have it in Matthew verses 10 and 11, oh, chapter 8, verses 10 and 11. When Jesus heard, this is about the Gentile whose servant is he healed.
Mm.
When Jesus heard, he marvelled and said to them that followed, "Verily I say unto you, I have not found so great a faith, no, not in Israel. And I say unto you, many shall come from the east and from the west, and shall sit down with Abraham and with Isaac and with Jacob in the kingdom of heaven."
Mm. It's an interesting verse, isn't it, in the context of talking about the faith of a non-Jew and saying many will come from all corners of the earth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting stuff. Let me just reiterate, if you're listening and you'd like to have your say on this, be great to hear from you as well. unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send me an email. You can follow on Twitter @unbelievablejb. I often post updates about the show and the guests I've got on and interesting articles and resources too. Same thing for the Facebook page, facebook.com/unbelievablejb. All the links and more and links to my guests on today's programme from the webpage of the show. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Now, getting back to the Halloween theme, just briefly before we have to go to our final break, Steve, one of the things that I think a lot of people do get concerned about is, well, we've heard that Samhain is not necessarily the same thing as what most people have in their heads as Halloween, but there is nevertheless still a kind of a focus on negative spiritual entities and that sort of thing. First of all, I'd be interested to find out from you, Tam, as well as communing, as you would say, with nature and the gods that you feel are represented within that cycle and so on, do you believe there is a negative spiritual dimension as well, something that many Christians might term the devil or demonic activity or that kind of thing?
Well, as I said, I'm green and grey.
Mm.
I believe in neither black nor white. The negative spirituality within the human being is within the human soul. There is no devil in our ways to deceive or to lead astray. If you lead yourself astray, it is you who have done it.
Mm.
On the other hand, we have compassion that even those who are evil have some good in them. Therefore, we do not have a battle between good and evil as such. We do have good and evil in the world and have to cope with it, emphasising the good, rejecting the evil. But it is not a war in heaven.
What do you make of traditions which do emphasise, let's say, calling upon Satan or that kind of a focus in their type of ritual?
They're fools.
Okay, so you're not quite as tolerant of those kinds of beliefs as...
If they want to do it, it depends what you mean. There are those who are Gnostic, who believe that, in fact, that God is occluded by a certain God, and that this mad God fights against Satan because Satan wishes to show the true God.
Right.
That is, in fact, a tradition that's been going on.
Yeah.
They're not the ones we're talking about, though.
No.
We're talking about the idiots who would run around and basically cause harm.
Right.
Or, by thoughts, cause harm.
And you would not want to be associated with those? Because I think very often the word witch immediately conjures up, oh, you're the same as maybe someone who calls himself a Satanist or something else.
Well, originally, I mean, in the period of the early modern age, when looking at people like Spengler and Cramer, for instance, the Jesuits, or James, James the Sixth, who you call the First, you get an idea of this bunch of people running around being Satanists and killing. But they were the ones who died. I mean, it wasn't they who hung people. It wasn't they who drew and quartered Catholic priests for saying the Mass. It wasn't they who created the auto da fe. So, again, I have a bit of...
We've got a historical blind spot there, to some extent, in terms of who...
I mean, and it's very interesting because you raise that, but societies, and I think this is getting into the public mythology of witchcraft, in a sense. Societies have, in most cultures, times and places, had groups of people who they were scared of or they blamed for things that were going wrong in the world around. And these beliefs are surprisingly common. There's something about how we seem to organize ourselves as human. So the ancient Romans had a crime of Lucerna Extincta, lights out, which was where groups of people who were seditious to society would gather in some underground place in the dark, have an orgy, and then they would turn up 9 months later and sacrifice the children.
Right.
One of the groups of people who were regularly accused of this were early Christians. But this is, of course, is the formulation of the classic medieval witchcraft belief.
Sure.
So, you know, and I think we have to see that for what it is. Unfortunately, I think it sometimes even resurfaces in our own day, and we saw bits of it in the satanic ritual abuse craze in the late 80s and early 90s. You know, so these things sound medieval, but they're still part of our psyche.
Yes.
But I think we have to distance that part of our psyche from what a contemporary pagan would do or believe.
Do you believe in a demonic realm in that sense, Steve?
Yes, I think I do. Now, I'm going to be very careful with my language here because, I mean, we've already talked about Halloween, you know, and little kids running around in devil costumes. And part of the stuff here is we do not know in our culture whether we take spiritual evil seriously and are scared of it, or whether it's a joke.
Mm.
And I think that's part of the way our culture is trying to deal with this thing going on and in the back of our minds. I think if I want to get back to biblical imagery here, there's a lot of what emerges as the Christian understanding of the devil, and I'm putting big inverted commas around it, is about a chaos monster, and it's almost like the battle, if you like, is between creation and uncreation, and this chaos monster, which is taken out of Canaanite and Near Eastern mythology as a seven-headed dragon, is that force which destroys and distorts and corrupts. Now, that, I think, for me, is the origin of some spiritually destructive forces that I would label evil that I think exist. I then want to say that how one handles that, I think, is quite important. I have occasionally encountered people who I think are in the grip of something spiritually quite destructive, and those people need help. I think sometimes some Christians are too quick to see that force at work when there are other explanations. Yeah. So I want something balanced and wise.
It's the sort of the C.S. Lewis approach of there is two equal and opposite errors to fall into, disbelieving entirely and believing so fervently that you think you see Satan under every nook and cranny.
Absolutely,
sort of
absolutely.
Yeah.
I would very much be on that position.
Yeah, but anyway, great stuff. Well, we're going to take another quick break and we'll start to wrap up today's conversation on Halloween, witchcraft and Christianity. And it's great to have in studio with me today Steve Hollinghurst, who we were just hearing from there, Christian guest who regularly engages with New Age and pagan community. And our witch today is Tam. I don't know if you laugh every time I say witch, Tam. Is that not the way would you use the word witch of yourself, or would you simply say I'm a Wiccan?
It's a generic and very widely term. I'm thinking, for instance, of the cunning folk of the old days who were the true witches, who would have their office in the main street of the village. Often would be people like the local vicar,
right,
who would certainly heavily cooperate with the church, especially in house blessing. For instance, a cunning folk person wouldn't come and banish evil spirits from a house until the vicar had been to bless the house.
Right, interesting. Well, look, we'll take a break and we'll come back anyway. I hope you can come back too for the final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, in just a moment's time. Welcome back to Unbelievable, the third part of today's show, and we're going to be getting back into the final part of our discussion with our Wiccan and our Christian guest on today's programme. If you come back at the same time next week for Unbelievable, you'll hear the discussion that I promised you for this week between Bible scholar Peter Enns and David Instone Brewer. Well, what we're going to be hearing is a discussion whether we need to rethink the way that we read Scripture. Peter Enns is a Bible scholar from the US, and he thinks that we do, and in his new book, The Bible Tells Me So, he claims that Christians are so focused sometimes on defending Scripture that they've forgotten how to read it. Well, my other guest is going to be Cambridge New Testament scholar David Instone Brewer, and he believes that, well, Enns has gone too far, basically, throwing out the historical baby with the bathwater, as it were, in terms of his scepticism of some of the claims of Scripture. So they're joining me for a discussion next week, and I hope you enjoy it too, here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Don't forget, if you want to listen back to today's show, or indeed to many past shows, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable is your portal to all things apologetic. There's also videos, features, the blog, and much more besides. Later on today's programme, we're going to be hearing some of your feedback, especially to last week's programme on abortion. James Mumford and Anne Furedi joined me to debate that. We're also going to be hearing later on here on Premier the profile. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. So if you stick around for that, you'll be hearing singer Lou Fellingham in conversation with John Pantry and author Carl Martin in conversation with Joy Tibbs. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. For now, let's get into the final part of today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So concluding this discussion on Halloween, witches, spooks, what happened and what actually doesn't really happen when you are a Wiccan and you're involved in celebrating certain seasons and festivals of the year. Today's guest, special guest, is Tam, who's in to talk about his beliefs and practices as a Wiccan, and Samhain, which is the sort of more traditional terminology for what is often comes to be termed Halloween, that part of the year that we're approaching very shortly. Steve Hollinghurst, my Christian guest also, as we conclude today's discussion. You have represented what your perspective is on this issue, on witchcraft, for want of a better word, the Wiccan tradition. It was almost interesting, though, to hear you say earlier on that in the modern world, you know, you almost see yourself as somehow fighting against, as probably many Christians would feel, a certain sort of commercial and over-the-top sort of, you know, presentation of Halloween and everything. Is Wicca itself under threat in any way in our modern age, which is probably more and more, you know, doesn't really engage with nature and the kind of issues that obviously are so close to your heart, Tam?
We actually are the opposite. Because we, like the forest churches, which are excellent, go into nature, we act as a sort of counterpoint to a lot of what is going on. We will never wish to be a massive, great, sort of popular, super popular thing. We are for those who want to be.
Mm.
There is no threat from commercialism or from the mundane world of boring capitalism, if you like to be said, basically because most of the people who wish to have their hearts set in that way would not be in that world.
Mm.
Of the others, well, we all have a mission to make people's lives better.
Are you happy walking into a church yourself, Tam, sitting down and, you know, being in that kind of an environment? I mean, you don't start to smoke or anything when you see a crucifix or anything like that.
I'm perfectly happy. And at times I will walk into a church if there's funerals and stuff. People who are I've respected who are Christian, I will have no problems with walking in there. Mm. I actually helped in the last funeral, which sadly was one of my brothers. I mean, brothers in the craft, who died. And we and his group actually conducted the funeral, which was great because the widow was most happy to have us do so.
Mm. It's been really fascinating having you in to talk about your way of life and your perspective as a Wiccan. Thank you for joining us to talk about Halloween as well in that context. So you're going to be out doing strange things around a campfire on Halloween yourself.
they're going to be particularly strange, actually. I just, you know, it's just nice to be able to connect with the seasons and actually help people reflect about what's going on. I think one of the things we haven't said so far is that Halloween or Hallows marks the end of the season of harvest, which starts in August with Lammas, which is actually a shared Christian pagan festival. It's an old Saxon term for loaf mass. So you start with the barley and the grain, and you end with the apples, and this is where all the apple games and stuff come from. So we'll have some apple related things as well to remind people of what's going on in the season. But a lot of what happens in Halloween traditions is all about the fact you're entering the winter months. It's the time when the poor would potentially go hungry. So the trick-or-treat tradition comes from people going round begging for food on people's doorsteps. And all of this, of course, has been commercialised, as we've said. So what we're trying to do is get people back beyond the commercialisation to, well, what's really going on at this time of year? And so we'll do things related to that. We'll use some Celtic prayer. We'll have some song. We will have mulled cider, you know, and all sorts of things to celebrate the season and reflect on what's going on.
And for those who raise an eyebrow at this, what do you say to those who think, I don't know, it all sounds a bit pagan and a bit, you know, it doesn't sound, I don't know, what would you say to someone who really does just feel like it sounds dodgy, Steve? Because you can just imagine lots of people
way. I get people asking me exactly those questions. I think what's fascinating about that is, why do people ask those questions? Because partly what I'm doing is simply actually recovering very long-standing Christian traditions, actually. Mm. You know, I think our early church ancestors would have thought it intensely normal. It's just we have turned it into something that happens on a Sunday morning in a building. Mm. And there is actually very little different. It's just the way we're engaging with the context. Many people find God in nature, and that is all, in a sense, we're doing. And I would say to people, look, explore it. There are books about Forest Church out there and things on people exploring this. We've just produced a new one called Earthed, which is a number of Christians talking about how they connect with nature. So I would say explore it. And I would say, from my view, it's a thoroughly Christian and, yeah, and actually, you know, surprisingly orthodox thing to do.
It's been great to have you on as well, Tam. Thank you. Thanks for doing that. And if people want more information, I suppose the Pagan Federation is a good place for a general overview of what exists. But Children of Artemis is another website that I managed to locate you through. So thank you very much for coming in. And your blog, Steve, onearthasinheaven.blogspot.com.
Yeah, and actually look for Forest Church. Forest Church Facebook
as well.
If
you're interested in that kind of perspective, so be interested in your thoughts as well about today's program. Give you a chance to get those in this week and see what you have to say on next week's program. But for the moment, thank you very much, and my thanks again to Steve and Tam for joining me on the program, and thanks for listening. And we'll be hearing some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming in just a moment's time.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, once again, if you want to get in touch, then you can do that via the webpage. You can actually leave comments now underneath the individual shows that we have. That's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And you can also, of course, get in touch via Facebook and Twitter. Here's one from Rachel, who did just that via Facebook. Says, because of my past experience, which is a long story, I had a determined avoidance of useless argument, which over the years had expanded its boundaries to leaving the brainy stuff to those who enjoyed it. One Saturday afternoon, a few years ago now, I was working on some pipes and physically could not get to the radio to turn it off. I listened to Unbelievable. I continued listening every week. I heard some lovely, clever, Jesus-filled people, and I just read some sad comments on your post about your Mark Driscoll interview. I realised that I had not yet said thank you, so thank you, Justin. I'm still simple, hopefully in the John Wesley sense of the greatest treasures being accessible to the simplest person, but I love listening to wise teaching, and through your programme I've discovered some really brainy, but wise and humble people too. Thank you. Thank you, Rachel. That was lovely to receive that via Facebook this week. I'm not sure what kind of pipes, you leave that slightly open-ended, you were working on. Plumbing pipes, organ pipes. Be interested to know why that stopped you getting to your radio. But anyway, I'm glad it did and that you've been listening every week ever since. So if you want to get in touch via Facebook like Rachel did, why not check out the Unbelievable page on Facebook? That's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. Or if you want to follow on Twitter, it's @unbelievablejb. And if you want to just do it the traditional way, email me. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Okay, let's hear some of your comments then on last week's programme. We had James Mumford, who's a Christian ethicist and has written a feature on abortion, particularly in regard to the way that disability is often treated when it comes to abortion. And he has written that for Premier Christianity magazine in the new November edition. Well, he was in conversation with Anne Faraday, who is the head of the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, the UK's largest independent abortion provider. And they had a really interesting discussion on the rights and wrongs of aborting in the instance of disability. Is it a modern form of eugenics, as James claimed on the programme? Well, here's Naomi Cunningham, who writes, almost 14 years ago, when I was pregnant with my third child, I was told, following the standard 20-week scan, that the baby I was carrying would be likely to have Down syndrome and a life-threatening heart defect. My baby had no mitral valve and no septum in the middle of the heart. The advice offered was to terminate the pregnancy, as it was highly likely the baby would die in the womb, and if not, shortly after birth. I'd always said I would never abort a baby and continued with the pregnancy. Today, that baby is a very happy, reasonably healthy 13-year-old girl. Yes, she has Down syndrome, and yes, she'd required life-saving heart surgery at 10 weeks of age. To date, she has not required any further surgery. She's a wonderful girl who brings joy to the majority of people she meets, maybe not to those of us who would have preferred to abort her. During the early difficult days when she was very ill, both me and my husband turned to God and eventually became committed Christians. She has taught us far more than anyone could ever have imagined. What I find unbearable to imagine is the outcome if we had been persuaded to abort her. It's Naomi who left a comment over at the premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable web page under the program. Here's Mike Sanchez, also comments there at the website, says, just finished listening to the podcast and it definitely pulls at my heart in a very personal way. When my wife became pregnant 12 years ago, we went through the usual checkups and the doctor sat us down and explained to us that all of the test results said that our daughter was to be born with Down syndrome. They then asked what we wanted to do. I'll say that my wife and I were both very troubled with this news, but we explained to the doctor that abortion was not an option for us. However, they continued to explain to us that our daughter would have lots of struggles and health issues if we were to decide to keep her. Long story short, my daughter is now 12, going on 13, and she was not born with Down syndrome. She's a healthy seventh grade girl who makes all A's in school, is in sports, and plans on growing up to be a paediatrician who specializes in the area of cancer patients. It makes me wonder how many of the hundreds and even thousands of children that are disposed of based on a poor medical diagnosis could have been saved if we didn't treat the unborn with so very little dignity. And spoke of the autonomy of the mother. But what about the rights of the child? It's a terrible thing we do when we steal the rights of the ones who cannot defend themselves, and the unborn are the most vulnerable to this type of discrimination. Thank you very much. Interesting message, Mike. Two somewhat similar but obviously different stories emerging there of people who believed, at least, that they had been screened for Down syndrome during pregnancy. Okay, so those were both on the website. Here's some that came in via email as well. Ricky in Edinburgh says, fascinating debate. It was between a pro-life stance and a pro-choice stance. Both participants made appeals to ethics and morality to defend their positions, but neither appealed to God or scripture. This could have been a debate between two Christians, or equally, it could have been a debate between two atheists. Aside from the closing comments where we learned for the first time that Anne doesn't believe in God, God didn't really get a mention. It certainly didn't come across as a Christian versus non-Christian debate like you usually favour on your show. Given that, I wonder, was Unbelievable the right place to air this debate? Well, I appreciate what you're saying. In the first time, you know, a few weeks ago when we again did an abortion debate, we made explicit, I think, that this isn't necessarily a Christian versus non-Christian debate. There's differences of opinion. But I think it's fair to say, Ricky, that in broad terms, most Christians are pro-life when it comes to this issue. And that, again, in broad terms, most in the secular world, as far as I can see, are pro-choice when it comes to this issue. So I think there is a broad spectrum that falls into those camps. Having said that, I still think it's an issue that needs debating on a purely ethical, not just scriptural grounds. And Unbelievable kind of does that. So thank you, though, for getting in touch. Alison says, I listened with interest to the very well-mannered debate on the topic, which caused mental and emotional anguish some 30 years ago for me. At that time, blood tests were routinely given to rule out spina bifida. So with my first child, I knew no differently. Two abnormal blood test results meant I was given the option of an amniocentesis, with the risks attached to that procedure, followed by a three-week wait for the results, by which time I was 20-plus weeks. My concern, what will I do if the results prove something is wrong, were met by, well, you wouldn't want to have a handicapped child, would you? You can always try again, by family. Thankfully, the results were okay, but I would have felt under pressure to abort if they had been otherwise, and there would have been fear of being alone or selfish if I decided to continue with a pregnancy where the child was handicapped. I chose to refuse all tests with my next two pregnancies. I did not want to be in the position to have to decide with all that that would entail. Anyway, you go on to say in this email, Alison, that I had the radio on in the kitchen when I was listening, and I was washing up whilst our eldest son was doing some work. So he heard the first half an hour of the discussion. I asked him what he thought, and it was interesting that he fully agreed with Anne Faraday's position that the unborn child has no rights. It is the mother who has all the rights until birth. That made me think that unless you do have a point of reference outside of yourself and your own thoughts, such as a faith which says life is sacred from conception, that point of view seems quite logical. Thank you for the programme. My hope and prayer will would be that women and men facing these choices would receive good care, information and support whatever they decide. Okay, thank you very much for getting in touch, Alison. Really interesting comments coming in for this programme that we had last week on abortion. Chris in Moldova says, though we learnt that Anne Faraday believes a woman's right to choose trumps even homosexual rights, if the woman thinks she cannot cope with bringing up a homosexual child in the same way she might not cope with raising a disabled child or a female child, the whole premise is based on a lie. No science worthy of the name has shown a homosexual gene, and scripture itself is clear on the origins and developments of homosexuality. There are no homosexual children in the womb, says Chris. Well, that wasn't really the point, I suppose, of raising that moral dilemma that I sort of put to Anne last week. I did say purely hypothetically, if they could, if it was possible to screen for homosexuality in the womb, would that make any difference to her belief that women should be able to abort for any reason, including even possibly that reason? I wasn't claiming that obviously there is any science in that direction either way, but thank you for your email, Chris. What was interesting, obviously, was that Anne stood by her guns, you know, logically speaking, and said, yes, even under that circumstance, as an otherwise liberally minded person, I would defend a woman's right to abort a child on the basis that they might be gay. So anyway, thank you for getting in touch. Here's Katie, who says, great job moderating. Thank you for all your hard work. Couple of comments on the recent show, particularly the one between James and Anne. My older brother was born with Down syndrome and myself with cerebral palsy. I think James did an incredible job of representing those of us who experience disability. I was also surprised and pleased to hear that both guests found Richard Dawkins' Twitter comments appalling. James was also right when he stated that there's often underlying medical predisposition for doctors to encourage families to consider an abortion when tests reveal the presence of Down syndrome or another disability. Whether or not Anne realises it, the question of whether to have an abortion simply because a fetus has a disability comes dangerously close to eugenics. Right to life issues are particularly sensitive and pertinent to those of us who have a disability, because we know how precious and valuable life is. People who have disabilities can make irreplaceable contributions to society and to their families and friends, in spite and because of the many additional challenges they may face. Having said that, I deeply appreciate the point she was making. We have to be concerned about the welfare of women. Although I am and always have been staunchly pro-life, human life is irreplaceable and begins biologically at conception. I have deep sympathy and compassion for women who feel that they must have an abortion because they've no other choice. Many women lack the social, familial or financial support to raise a child, and that can be overwhelmingly frightening if you find that you're unexpectedly pregnant. While in college, I sang outside an abortion clinic to try to dissuade women from going in, and it was heartbreaking. I'm sure there are exceptions, but in the US, most Planned Parenthood clinics are in poor areas where few resources are available to women who would wish to seek other options such as adoption or financial and emotional support that would allow them to keep the baby if they wished. Organisations like Project Rachel or Sisters for Life are few and far between, and that needs to be fixed, especially in undeveloped countries. Counselling too needs to be more widely available. In general, women need more support, particularly when they're faced with an unwanted pregnancy. And while I would find an abortion understandable under certain dire circumstances, it's never generally the best choice for the woman. Abortion procedures are often far riskier and more traumatic for women than childbirth, and can leave permanent psychological scars. Infertility may also result. While I don't know that much about the abortion pill and acknowledge that physical but not psychological risks might be reduced by that method, it ultimately comes down to whether the fetus is a human being deserving of life. Ultimately, I think the answer is always yes. So we need to do whatever we can for the woman to encourage her to do what's right, both for her and the baby. Okay, lots of interesting perspectives here. And here's Simon, who says, I want to start by offering a salute to all the caregivers and parents that have raised or are caring for ill and disabled children. I salute you. I want to honour you for the daily self-sacrifice made. You are precious jewels in humanity's crown. Well, regarding the recent podcast with Anne Faraday and James Mumford, while it was refreshingly civil in tone, it was not what was stated that I wanted to hone in on, but what I consider is the 800-pound gorilla in the room. And you've given me 6 points here to read out. I'll see if I can get through them, Simon. First, being a champion for women's rights to choice should never take precedence over one's personal moral conscience ever. However, that seemed to be the stance Anne was implicitly exercising. To fail to listen and, most importantly, act upon one's inner witness is itself a moral failing, the silent numbing and destruction of one's own innate moral intuitions. Two, for Anne to endorse moral relativism, as I think she does, might seem like a noble gesture, that is, until it's her daughter that was gang-raped. Then it's an abhorrent and heinous act to which the guilty parties all sing in chorus, says who. No moral relativist can ever live consistently with their conscience. Moral relativism is both unlivable and, secondly, will always end in self-contradiction. Thirdly, Anne assumes that an individual human life has some inalienable and autonomous value protected by law, but fails at demarcating what, if any, value a fetus has, or why fetal value is inferior until born. Four, a woman's right to choice doesn't magically trump all other consequences and responsibilities of a woman's or man's actions. The right to choice isn't a magic wand to make inconvenient circumstances, mistakes, tragedies, hardship, commitment, self-sacrifice and misfortunes disappear. The magic wand approach presumes that an adult life is somehow wasted if, while looking into a crystal ball, the future is only bleak and squandered if made to endure an unwanted pregnancy or negative diagnosis. Five, now I want to state the obvious. There are real consequences when human beings engage in sex: emotional, psychological, STDs, marriage breakups, and shockingly, you can even fall pregnant, have to pay child maintenance, care for children with health problems, die while giving birth, need a bigger house and more income. And are you ready for it? There are even consequences for being sexually irresponsible. If you're old enough to engage in sex, then you're old enough to be taught and understand these most basic human realities. Again, women's right to choice is not a fairy dust to discharge men and women of their responsibility for the actions they took. And finally, number six, you say, a woman's right to choice says nothing about the third person involved in a pregnancy, the rights of a potential father. It says nothing about their psychological damage, their emotional distress at the prospects of a termination. And you finish by saying, you love the show, think I do a sterling job. Thank you very much, Simon. So a lot of emails there and thoughts and comments. Haven't read all of them out by any means from last week's programme. If you want to listen back to it, it's on the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there as well to where you can find the original article that inspired the discussion from James Mumford. And you can find that also on the Premier Christianity website at premierchristianity.com. And if you do visit the website of Premier Christianity magazine, well, you'll be able to find some other really interesting articles. We sort of have had a women's focus in the latest edition, and you can find an article that's really causing a lot of interest on head covering. This is journalist Heather Tomlinson, who has decided to put into practice the Apostle Paul's commands in 1 Corinthians 11 about women covering their heads. Now, most Christians hold that that's a sort of culturally bound command for a particular people, a particular situation, particular time. But read what Heather got out of actually adopting the practice of head covering. And you can do that at premierchristianity.com. We've also got some interesting other features up there as well. Some great testimonies, some of which you might have heard on Unbelievable. But also a blog as well. I mentioned last week that I've been blogging on Mark Driscoll. This last week I blogged on Sir Alan Sugar, the man in charge of The Apprentice, and asked, would Jesus get fired by Lord Sugar? And I surmise that he would, and have given five reasons why. If you want to read that, it's at the premierchristianity.com/blog. Coming up later on here on Premier, Dave Rose will be here with Premier Playback between 5 and 6. But right now we're going to be hearing the profile. Today's guests are singer Lou Fellerman and Pastor Carl Martin. I've been Justin Briley. Thank you for joining me on today's programme. And let me tell you what's coming up on Unbelievable next week. You're unbelievable. Well, we're asking, do we need to rethink the way we read Scripture? Not the first time we've debated such a topic. But Peter Enns is the latest person who's written a book saying that we need to be careful as Christians not to focus so much on defending Scripture that we forget how to read it. It's called The Bible Tells Me So. He'll be on the line from the US in conversation with Cambridge-based Bible scholar David Instone Brewer. Well, David believes that Peter Enns has gone too far, throwing out the baby with his sceptical bathwater, as it were, and they're going to be discussing some of the issues that book raises in terms of whether we should take the Bible literally, how far we should take it literally, how far we should treat it as metaphorical and theological and that kind of thing. So if you're interested in that, come back next week and I'm sure you'll be interested in the discussion. That's here on Unbelievable between 2:30 and 4 next Saturday, or as usual online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. I look forward to seeing you next week. In the meantime, we're going to be hearing from our profile guests in just a moment.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.